For 2 Kings chapter 5 and verse 14. Then went he down and dipped himself seven times in Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God. And his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him. And he said, Behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant. But he said, As the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. I'm sure you've heard this story since your days in primary Sunday school class. A very accomplished man in the Syrian military who has reached the pinnacle of his career. He's a decorated military man. He holds the highest rank in the Syrian army. He's a national hero. And you really couldn't say enough good things about him, but no matter how much you say about him, it is overshadowed by one phrase. But he was a leper. Leprosy was the most contagious, it was the most defiling, it was the most loathsome disease in the world of the Old Testament. It really was a death sentence because there was no cure for it. In fact, there is still no cure for leprosy. A leper became an outcast of society because it was so feared and because it was so contagious. Lepers were segregated from the rest of the community. And really, probably the most terrible thing that could be discovered in the Old Testament about any man was that he had the dreaded disease of leprosy. And I'm sure that Naaman has tried every ointment, he's tried every salve, he's tried every medicine, every doctor, every hospital, every suggested cure, every old wives' fable, every homemade remedy, and all of it was to no avail. In his position, he has access to the best doctors, to the best medicine that money can buy, but nothing can be done for him. The disease is going to continue to spread. It would eventually eat away at his limbs and his extremities. He would lose weight and muscle. The sores would ooze continuously, and then he would die. But the story takes an incredible turn with the introduction of a little maid. The Syrians had gone on a war raid, and they had kidnapped and brought back with them a young girl from the land of Israel. And this little girl is given to Naaman's wife as a personal servant. She has been taken away from her family, and she is made to serve a wealthy family. But she's been raised in a godly home. She's been taught that Jehovah God is the only true God. She has an incredible faith in that God. And true to the heart of God's people, instead of hating her captor, she pities her master and she wants to see him healed. And this little maid has heard of the prophet named Elisha and the miracles that he is known to perform. And she's convinced that if Naaman can somehow get to Elisha, that he could be cured even of his leprosy. And so the story is of a Syrian captain traveling to see a Hebrew prophet hoping for a miracle. And when Naaman comes to Elisha, he comes to him with his royal entourage, surely thinking that he could impress the man of God. It's interesting, Elisha doesn't come out to meet him. Instead, Elisha just sends his servant out to him with a message. Because Naaman needs to be healed, but first he needs to be broken. He comes as a general who just happened to be a leper. He needs to be treated, though, as a leper who just happened to be a general. And at first, Naaman is insulted in the instructions, dip seven times in the muddy waters of the Jordan River. Who ever heard of such a thing? What kind of insult is that? How is that going to help? Elisha surely must just be mocking me. But when you are a leper, you have nothing to lose and you will try anything. So Naaman swallows his pride and he does as the man of God instructs, and he is instantly healed of this dreaded disease. Naaman thought that he would just die if he dips in the Jordan. But in truth, he's going to die if he doesn't dip in the Jordan. But what I'm interested in tonight is the aftermath of the story. Because Naaman is so grateful for the miracle that he wants to reward Elisha, but Elisha refuses to take the gift. In fact, in verse number 5 of the story, you will read how that when Naaman came to Elisha, he brought with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, and 10 changes of raiment. Somewhere I've read that that gift would be in the neighborhood of $4 million in today's economy. When you are facing death, money is of no concern to you. There is no price that you wouldn't pay to spend one more day on earth. And so he offers this gift to Elisha, and Elisha steadfastly refuses to accept the gift. The Bible says that Naaman urged him, he constrained him, he argues with him, and Elisha would not take the money. I understand that. It would be kind of like you letting somebody pay you right after you led them to Christ. Well, I wouldn't want him to think that he's paid for his salvation. And this is a picture of salvation. And if Elisha would have taken that gift, it would have ruined the experience and the picture that salvation is a free gift you can't pay for the grace of God. Elisha says no. But Elisha has a servant named Gehazi. And the rest of the story is about this man Gehazi and how he schemes to get that offering for himself. He doesn't have the same standards. He doesn't have the same principles, the same morals, the same ethics as Elisha had. All that he sees is a pot of gold. And morals and ethics are not going to stand in his way of getting rich. So in verse number 20, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, "Behold, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him." So Gehazi followed after Naaman. And when Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master has sent me, saying, Behold, even now there be come to me from Mount Ephraim 2 young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and 2 changes of garments." When a man is confronted with the opportunity of riches, his true character comes out. And Gehazi is covetous. It is greedy. It is lying. It is disloyal to Elisha. He hatches this plan in his mind. He replays it over and over. He works all of the bugs out, makes sure that he's got it down. He builds up this big lie and he puts it into action. Catches up to Naaman and says that my master has sent me to you. And he doesn't want anything for himself, but he does have 2 young preacher boys in the school of the prophets, and they could use some help. And maybe you would like to give a small love offering to those 2 young preacher boys. And Naaman agrees. In fact, Naaman gives him twice of what he has asked for. And Gehazi goes away not with 1 talent of silver, but with 2 talents of silver and 2 changes of raiment. But the thing about it is that it's an out-and-out lie. Not an ounce of truth in it. And Gehazi knew that it was lying. But covetousness has blinded him so that he can lie with a straight face and never be bothered by it. Now here's what's disturbing about Gehazi. Is Gehazi is not a pagan. Gehazi is the servant of the man of God. We have preached several times on some of the miracles of Elisha in the last several months. And Elisha, one of the most powerful men of the Old Testament, performed twice as many miracles as Elijah did. And think of the privilege that it would be of getting to be with Elisha day by day and serving him. Gehazi has a front seat to all of those miracles. He is right there when Elisha preached. He worked shoulder to shoulder with the greatest man of God of his day.
In fact, I'll show you in a minute how that in the chapter before, Elisha was going to perform a miracle, and he didn't even go himself. He just sent Gehazi to do the miracle for him on his behalf. Gehazi has great privilege. And I always think of the great privilege that you and I have in our Christianity. I think about our young people, our children. And you know that you are in a favored position. And you got a Christian home. You got a good church. You have a phenomenal preacher. If you go to a Christian school, perhaps. And Elisha had the touch of God on him, and Gehazi was right there with him. He has heard this man pray. He has seen this man preach. He has watched this man perform miracles. And so though he may be a servant, he is greatly blessed. He is in a privileged position, but in a day, he's going to lose all of that, and he's going to go from privilege to curse. And it is a tragic tale. I want you to notice three things about Gehazi tonight. I'm going to be quick. We've got youth choir practice tonight. They're learning a new song, and so they will practice here in just a minute. But I want you to notice, first of all, the contrast between Naaman and Gehazi. Because you see, sometimes the Bible sets two men next to each other who are polar opposites for the sake of contrast. Cain and Abel. Jacob and Esau. David and Saul. He sets men next to each other so that you can examine each life and that you can see the contrast, the good and the bad. And in this story, Naaman and Gehazi stand next to each other, and there is a glaring contrast, and it is this. Naaman is a great man by the world's standards. He has position, he has power, he has accomplishments, he has accolades, he has really achieved greatness in the eyes of the world, and he enjoyed everything that the world had to give. Gehazi, on the other hand, is insignificant. He really has nothing that the world would deem valuable. He has no position, he has no power, he has no wealth. And by the world's standards, Gehazi is just a servant. So when the world looks at Naaman and they look at Gehazi, they see two totally different things. By the way, the world may look at you and not be impressed. Don't be worried about it. Because the world has a different value system. They look at who you are and what you believe and what you have accomplished. And the world is not impressed. They value things differently. And what you have and what you are, they do not esteem as valuable. But Gehazi and Naaman stand next to each other. And here's the contrast. Gehazi had God, and Naaman didn't. And really, Gehazi is the most privileged. He doesn't have all the trappings of wealth and success, but he does have the blessings of God surrounding him. And for all of the things that Naaman has that money can buy, he couldn't buy the favor of God on his life. He tried, but he couldn't. But here's the contrast. Neither man was satisfied. Naaman would have traded all that the world had given him to have the blessing of God. Gehazi would trade the blessing of God to have all that the world could give him. Naaman looked at the blessings of the world and said, "It is not enough. I need what God can give me." Gehazi looked at the blessings of God on his life and said, "It is not enough. I want what the world can give me." Proverbs 23 and verse 17. "Let not thy heart envy sinners, but be thou in the fear of the Lord all the day long." You know, sometimes teenagers will look at pop stars or whoever's on... they don't have Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or Who Wants to Marry, Who Wants to Be a Star, whatever they have nowadays. And they look at that and who's on The Voice or something like that. And they look at the popularity of some sports star. And it looks like that the world has all of the fun. Because they don't have any reproach. We have all the reproach. There's no reproach on their side. But hey, don't look at the world and envy that and don't desire that. I tell you, you only see what's being advertised. That's all that you say. It's not truth in advertising. And while Naaman is the envy of the world, God did not esteem what he had as very valuable. And while nobody envied Gehazi, what he did have was more valuable. I mean, he's a servant to one of God's preachers, and he's got a place to minister, and he has a place to serve, and his life is wrapped up in serving a man of God. And from God's perspective, he is better off than Naaman. And it may be that your station in life compared to some in the world is not that great, but I tell you that if you have the blessings of God in your life, you are among the richest people on the face of the earth. And so quit looking over the fence at the world and quit wishing that you had what they had and that you were where they are. No, don't you know that they look at your peace and their joy and they're wishing that they had what you have? Naaman seeks the prophet for help. Gehazi seeks Naaman for help. Gehazi thinks that Naaman can offer something that Elisha can't offer. And in reality, Naaman has nothing that Gehazi needs. Gehazi already has what he needs with the man of God. And isn't that just like us? We go to the world for peace and satisfaction when we already have it in Jesus. How can this world help you when it can't even help itself? Well, Naaman wants to express his thankfulness for God's blessing. Gehazi said God's blessing is not enough. Here is a man who has everything, but he doesn't have God. That's not enough. And here is a man who has God and nothing else. And he says, that's not enough. Contrast between Naaman and Gehazi. The second thought I want to give you tonight is the carnality that's left unattended in the past. Look at verse number 20. Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, behold, my master has spared Naaman this Syrian in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him. He gets it in his mind that he deserves this gift. And so he puts this scheme together and I'm going to get this money and Elisha will never know. He's going to be judged for it very severely. It's not going to be worth the price that it's going to cost him. But here's the question I have about Gehazi. Was this a one-time low point in an otherwise good life? Or is this his pattern? Do you know there are Christians who live for God and serve God and they're faithful for years? And then something happens. And they get out of church for a spell. Or maybe they fall into sin, they backslide. It is possible for you to be serving God and for you to be faithful and then to fall and have a low point. It's not your pattern. It's not where you stay. Not excusing it. David was a good man. Except in 2 Samuel chapter 11. That was a low point in his life. Peter preached with the power of God. But not on the night that he betrayed the Lord and denied Him. But see, that wasn't his pattern. You understand? That's not the pattern of his life. That was a low point in his life. And a good life, but a low point. And the truth is that all of us are prone to have a spiritually low point. But it doesn't mean that it has to be the pattern of our life. So here's what I want to know. Does Gehazi have a walk with God, but we're focusing on a low point in his life? Or is this the pattern of his life? Is this an indicator of what was in his heart all along? Is it an indication of a man who has no walk with God? Look if you would in chapter 4 tonight.
Back up to chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse number 25. This is the Shunammite woman. She had been childless. Elisha prays. God gives her a son. Some years have passed. The boy gets sick and he dies. And here she comes to Elisha to work a miracle. So in verse number 29, so she went and came unto the man of God to Mount Carmel. It came to pass when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to Gehazi his servant, behold, yonder is that Shunammite. Run now, I pray thee, to meet her and say unto her, is it well with thee? Is it well with thy husband? Is it well with the child? And she answered, it is well. And when she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught him by the feet. But Gehazi came near to thrust her away. And the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is vexed within her, and the Lord hath hid it from me, and hath not told me. So her son has died. She's coming to find Elisha. She needs a miracle. Now let me ask you a question. How do you think that she came? Just think about it for a minute. How do you think that she came? Slowly or quickly? Calmly or panicky? Smiling or crying? How would you come? So Elisha sends Gehazi out to meet her and inquire, is everything well? And she says, all is well. All is not well. You understand? You understand? She says, all is well. Everything is not well. She comes to Elisha, falls down at his feet, and she's weeping. And Gehazi wants to push her away. Now here's what it tells me. Now, I don't think I'm reading between the lines. It tells me he has no clue about what is going on. He has no spiritual discernment. He has no insight into the needs and the hearts of people. Could he not see that she has a problem? Could he not see that she is vexed in her spirit? Could he not read her countenance? And here's Gehazi. He has walked with the man of God, but he hasn't learned anything for himself. He has no insight. He has no discernment. He's not picking up on what is happening on a spiritual plane. He is oblivious to her needs. Elisha senses that something is wrong. Gehazi doesn't have that perception. So look at verse 29. Then Elisha said to Gehazi, gird up thy loins and take my staff in thy hand and go thy way. If thou meet any man, salute him not. If any salute thee, answer him not again. Lay my staff upon the face of the child. And the mother of the child said, as the Lord liveth and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee. And he arose and followed her. And Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff upon the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Wherefore he went again to meet him and told him, saying, the child is not awake. So here's what Elisha does. He gives his staff to Gehazi and says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go back with the Shunammite, go back to the house, and I want you to go into the bedroom where the son is laying, and I want you to lay my staff on the face of the child. Now think with me just a minute, all right? For Elisha to give that instructions presupposes two things. One, he must believe that the staff will work. Would you agree with that? Else why do this? Secondly, he must believe that the servant is able to do this. So Gehazi goes and he does as he is told, and nothing happens. Nothing. Gehazi has no power. He is the running mate of Elisha, but he has no power for himself. He is a powerless believer. And when it doesn't work, here's the only thing he knows to do, is to go back to Elisha. But why doesn't he pray? Why doesn't he get on his face and confess his weakness to God? And the reason why that he doesn't pray is because he doesn't have enough relationship with God to pray. There's nothing wrong with the staff, but there is a problem with Gehazi. He's in a good position. He has spiritual privileges. He's standing next to Elisha, but he's a dud. He's a fake is what he is. He participates in the ritual of ministry, but no power. He doesn't know how to get a hold of God. Don't know how to have the power of God in his life. Look, if you would, in verse number 42. Chapter 4, verse 42. There came a man from Baal-Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and 4 ears of corn and the husk thereof. And he said, give them to the people that they may eat. And his servitor said, what? Should I set this before 100 men? He said again, give the people that they may eat. For thus said the Lord, they shall eat and shall leave thereof. Now it doesn't name Gehazi by name, but it is the servant of Elisha. And I believe that it is Gehazi, but he doesn't have any faith. How is this little bread going to feed 100 men? His lack of spirituality, it becomes obvious when he speaks. And here's the thing about it. His failure should have been a wake-up call to him. It should have told him that this is time to get serious with God. Can he not see that he has nothing of what Elisha had? And when I look at the whole of his life, it adds up to me that it's not just the low point in a spiritual man's life. It is the pattern of his life. He is carnal. He seeks after the world. He is coveting after riches. And that carnality has never been dealt with. It's never been confessed. It's never been laid at the altar. And that carnality is one day going to cost him everything. A carnality that's been unattended in the past. It's the third thing that I would mention about Gehazi. And that is the curse that is pronounced on his life. Now come back to a question I asked at the beginning. Why didn't Elisha take that gift? Naaman brought treasure. So in Naaman's mind, he's going to pay for the miracle. But the miracle is a picture of salvation. And by Elisha not taking the gift, he's saying that you can't buy the gift of God. You can't buy salvation. You can't buy the blessing of God. You can't buy the power of God. So it's not just about money. Elisha is making a spiritual statement. Had Naaman been able to pay for the healing, then Naaman would have been able to go home and he would have been able to salvage some of his dignity and say that I purchased my healing. He's not able to do that. He's got to go home now and say that it was entirely of the grace of God. Everybody would have been getting up money to come and get a healing and get a touch of God. But he has to go back and he has to say that it is a gift of God. And when you understand that, then you understand why God is so angered at Gehazi, because he destroys the picture. He thought that Elisha was the fool for not taking the money, but really, he is the fool. And the carnal man likes to convince itself that it knows so much about spiritual things, but the carnal mind just doesn't see spiritual things. It just doesn't see it. So Gehazi schemes. He's been faking it all along, and it's going to come out. No power, no faith, no interest in God, no satisfaction with God. And God is going to give him an opportunity to show his true colors. He plans a dishonest agenda. His deception is deliberate. His sin is premeditated. He chases after Naaman. He tells an out-and-out lie. He adds one sin to another. And God lets him have his way. And there are many times that I look at a situation and I say, God, if I could be you for a day, I'd stop that. I'd stop that man in his tracks. I'd fix that. But sometimes, God will just let you have your way. And if you love God, He'll keep you from wrong. But if not, God will even lay a trap for you. So we look in verse 23, chapter 5. Naaman said, be content, take 2 talents. And he urged him, and bound 2 talents of silver and 2 bags with 2 changes of garments, and laid them upon 2 of his servants, and they bare them before him. And when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand and bestowed them in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said unto him, whence comest thou, Gehazi? And he said, thy servant went nowhither. I hadn't been anywhere. He executes the perfect plan. He has tricked Naaman into giving him the money. He has hid it in a tower and he has gotten away with it. and how deceptive carnality is. Achan thought that nobody would ever know he had taken the cursed thing. But God knew. And when Elisha questioned him, "Where you been?" it is God giving him one more time an opportunity to come true. Gehazi, you've been lying long enough. It's time to get honest. So in verse 26, Elisha said unto him, "Went not my heart with thee when the man turneth again from his chariot to meet thee?" Is it a time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants? Elisha knew exactly what he'd done because God had told him. Interesting thing in verse 26. You receive money, garments, olive yards, vineyards, sheep, oxen, men servants, and maid servants. Gehazi hadn't taken that. He had just taken money and garments. And here's what I believe that Elisha is saying. That God not only knows what you've done, what you did, God knows what the intent of your heart is to do. And I think that Gehazi, in his mind, had that money. "I'm going to buy me some livestock, and I'm going to buy me a vineyard. I'm not going to serve the man of God forever. I'm going to get me a little farm and do something else." And nothing wrong with having a little farm, but if God told you to do something else, then it is wrong. And I believe that Elisha is exposing the evil intent in his heart. God knows what is in your heart. This is what you plan to do with that money. And so verse 27. Elisha said, "The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever." And he went out from his presence a leper as white as snow. It's not just one day. It's not just one carnal choice. It's not just one unspiritual blip. It is the pattern of his life. God gave him an opportunity and he shows his true self and his carnality becomes his trap. You know that sometimes God will let you see just how powerless you are. God will put you in a situation. God will place you in a circumstance for you to expose yourself, if to nobody else, but to yourself. And when you see that, that should be a wake-up call. I need to get serious about God. I need to quit playing games. I need to get honest about my own lack of true spirituality. You look at how spiritually blessed he is, just like you. But he lost those blessings and received a curse. Curse of Gehazi.